Welcome to With All Due Respect. I'm Michael Jensen and I'm with...
Megan Powell-Dutoit.
That's great to have you this Anzac Day. Well, you might be listening to it on this Anzac Day, but you might be listening to it later. It's our Anzac Day special,
yes.
Nevertheless. And we're going to be talking about war. What is it indeed good for, if anything? We'll talk about the God of the Anzacs and then we'll talk about Australian war songs.
For argument's sake, where we take a debate, cut out the party politics and try to talk it out. And our debate is war. What is it good for?
And everyone's just said absolutely nothing. That's right. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah.
It's a controversial topic amongst Christians because Christians have been divided for a long time about whether war is something they could participate in, whether Christian governments should endorse war, Christians should endorse war. And we've seen cases in history where Christians have called for war. So we think, of course, of the actions of the Pope in the Crusades, for instance, in whipping up essentially a war and saying a war was actually God's command, a holy war. And in the contemporary world we live in, of course, with the associations between religion and violence, we still see that connection, and so what are Christians to do with it?
Not just Christians, but I think that's just a human, and any philosophy that humans bring into being, this becomes one of the major questions as to what role, if you like, sort of sanctioned violence has within it.
Yeah, and I think one of the leading theologians that I engaged with in my studies was a man called Stanley Hauerwas, and he's... you may have heard of him. He's a terrific scholar and advocate for all sorts of things. But someone said he's the pacifist you want on your side in a barroom brawl. He's an amazing man. And he's really put a strong case for Christians not being involved in violence in that way, because it's not really our business. Why do Christians have anything to say about whether a state involves itself in war? It's not what we do. And our Lord, the Lord we follow, is the one who said, turn the other cheek. Of course. So what business is it of ours to be soldiers, to be advocating for a war? It's not what churches do. It's not that church is a kingdom of peace. And surely if we're interested in ushering in God's new kingdom, that's a kingdom you would assume is without war.
But then we go back to, so far back in Christian theory, and just war theory has been there since Augustine.
Yeah, at least him,
since Augustine.
He's the guy who formulates it really clearly, and he says, well, no, of course, partly this is when the empire becomes Christian, so that you then have a Christian emperor who, of course, has got a sword in his hand. So what's that going to mean? How does a Christian go about thinking about war? How is it going to be justified to go to... Is there ever a case for a justified war? A pacifist would say, no, never. But,
or sort of further even, is there cases where it's not justified to be pacifist?
Right, what do you mean?
As in, and I think Augustine does get into that, is there a case where it's absolutely necessary to go to war ethically?
Yeah, and I mean, that's the argument, isn't it? Now, Baptists have had a long tradition of pacifism, Megan, so I want to ask you, do you have a pacifist heart?
I'd say I have a pacifist heart. I used to be a pacifist when I was younger, and now I call myself an agnostic on the question.
An agnostic. What's the journey you've taken?
I think as I've gone on in life and realised that in my perception, there is a lot of evil, that there's been no other way to counter it but with violence. There's a whole lot of parts of history where I think horrible, horrible things would have kept happening for a long time unless measures had been taken in that way.
But can't you think of sort of non-violent? I mean, aren't there non-violent responses to violence which actually don't perpetuate violence? I mean, isn't the problem with violence is that you're countering evil with a further evil?
And is that sometimes necessary? And I mean, that's why I said I'm an agnostic on it. I wouldn't say I hold to just war. I don't think that there's any way. I would not want to label war or violence just. But certainly also I think as I studied the Bible more that somehow we have to square our position. And I think it's too easy to say, oh, the New Testament has become non-violent. But because it's still the same God. So what do we do with the Old Testament story of war that was actually asked for by God?
Yeah, a lot of pacifist thinkers would say, well, that was invalid theology. They would dismiss the Old Testament. Mm. One way of doing that is to say, well, actually, no. Although Miroslav Volf, whose book Exclusion and Embrace has sort of changed my life, really. Mm. I love that book. He argues that pacifism is possible because you have a God who says, vengeance is mine.
Mm.
So he says, look, if you don't have a God who actually answers justice, then pacifism is a sort of indulgence. But if you've got a God who will enact justice on the earth, then you leave it, you defer it to him. It's not our business to do his business. We pray for his justice to come, and then we act as justly as we can, he says.
I mean, you're still dealing with a God, therefore, is bringing a particular type of justice, I think, and that has to form part of... I mean, I think he's trying to deal with that, but I think often a very simplistic pacifism doesn't deal with a God who does seem to use what we would see as violent acts in order to deal with the world.
So you didn't want to actually use the label just war, though?
No.
So why is that?
Because I am very taken with Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount and calling us to a different way. And I think violence is a response to a sinful world, and it's certainly not God's initial intention.
Might it then be an action of justice? I mean, don't governments do justice? I mean, we do something, we put someone in prison, that's a kind of act of violence. We do that, it's justice too, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think why I'm worried about it is because we know over history that using the idea of just war has been used to justify also, like it starts to justify a stance of violence, which I do not feel is one that Christians can take. But what about you?
So it's rationalized war rather than just war.
Yeah, I'm not one for the slippery slope argument, but I feel in this case... there is something for it. What about you? Are you pacifist or not?
No, although the kind of crew I was hanging out with when I was doing my postgraduate study were very much influenced by a lot of the theologians I was reading, a lot of the students I hang out with were very much influenced by pacifism, and I kind of went through a phase there.
Both had pacifist phases.
That's right. Although my uncle once said to me, you got to want to be a pacifist. Which I thought was you've got to have a pacifist heart because that's God's heart. He's the God of peace. So you can't be bellicose and be a Christian, I think. You can't kind of wish for war to reign upon the earth and glory in war. You must respond with horror and not romanticisation to war.
Which I would agree with. To bring up to Anzac, what do we do as churches with the whole Anzac tradition then?
Well, I think one of the things is to notice that in the secular way of thinking, or the pagan way of thinking, blood is needed to establish nations. And so what we've got is a sort of culture, a cult of the fallen dead. And that's our temptation with the Anzac myth, I think, is to make it a blood myth where there's blood sacrifice, which has made our nation what it is. And I think while we honour people who went to war on our behalf. And I think Jesus doesn't tell soldiers to leave their soldiering. Mm. He says it's okay to be a soldier.
Or there's a silence there.
Yeah, he tells soldiers to be just.
Yeah.
But soldiers. He doesn't say soldiers.
I wouldn't go so far as to say he says it's okay to be a soldier. That's probably the next step beyond.
Well, it's an opportunity where he could have said, soldiers, stop being soldiers.
Yeah. Okay, I'm agreeing with that.
Yeah, although a lot of the early Christians were kind of dubious about whether Christians could be soldiers. So the point is not to kind of pick on people who went to war and say, you know, that's terrible and I don't value that. The question is this actually another religion, and are we glorifying bloodshed rather than bemoaning it? Because that's a temptation I think we have.
And I feel like it's gone more that way particularly from the World War One and World War Two, as those people have started to die off, and it's become more of a sort of myth, legend kind of feeling to it. Even in my own lifetime, I feel like the way that we talk about the Anzac tradition and the way that we celebrate Anzac Day has changed. It felt like it was a more simply a commemoration in the past.
And also a reunion.
Yeah.
The 70s in particular. Do you remember the 70s?
A little.
It was not well attended, except by the soldiers. And then there were protests, actually. It was a kind of a tense moment for us. But it's become now a moment of pilgrimage and quasi-religious ceremony, which is, I think, interesting. And I don't want to be in the situation where I'm baptizing or dignifying violence in that conversation, while at the same time I do want to honour what people did and how people served.
And the interesting thing, I think, is that it had more of a connection to... It was more like a funeral service initially. And, in fact, a lot of the Anzac traditions were started by Canon Garland, who was an Anglican minister up in Queensland, and that was his idea. But that sort of seems to have got stripped away, so that the way that we celebrate Anzac now has more of that idea of we're celebrating something about Australia.
Yes, it's about our nation and our national character,
yeah,
which is formed through bloody sacrifice. And, you know, the bloody sacrifice makes what our freedoms. That's the language, isn't it?
And as the changes happen, I feel like women... and other people, but I feel like women have then been excised from that commemoration because it's become about the a very male myth of what it is to be Australian.
So, and that was always the case, though, wasn't it? It kind of grows out of the larrikin, slightly anti-authoritarian,
which is a very gendered word, larrikin. We don't tend
absolutely
to call women that.
What's a female version of a larrikin? Don't even know.
Well, it would have a negative tone to it, I'd suggest. I think. I actually was doing a bit of reading into this, and apparently the nurses were very involved initially in Anzac commemoration, and that it was very meaningful for them to stand alongside the soldiers and meaningful for the soldiers. But gradually the nurses become less centred in the story, and I'm not sure I've heard the nurses really talked about.
There was an ABC show which was entirely... based on the nursing
issues. Well, yes, but I mean, in the Anzac tradition, the way that we talk about it, yeah, as you say, it's larrikinism. It's mateship, which has always been sort of, it sounds like a great concept, but I've always felt rather disconnected from it as a woman, I think, because it's sort of a very...
No,
that's
a,
what men
it's
do.
It's very male-oriented. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
So it's interesting that it's meant to be something that we as Australians can hold on to, but it's an exclusionary kind of tradition, and not just of women, I think.
Well, I'm interested too in that it is the very much the white Australia is the Anzac legend, and actually there are much bigger mix of ethnicities fighting in the AIF than we realise. But it was fascinating to me once teaching a class on the Australian novelist David Maluth's Second World War book about Changi, the Great World, and I was teaching this class, and almost everyone in the class was of Asian descent.
Mm.
And to talk to them, I started off the class by saying, "What's the war experience of your grandparents?" And of course, it just didn't. I thought the whole war thing, the war experience, was a sort of white Anglo-Saxon thing. But of course, if the Second World War was something that the people of Southeast Asia had in their territory, and they were massively displaced, and of course people had ended up in Australia often because their parents had to leave Singapore or Malaysia or Thailand or wherever it was, or Hong Kong or China. There was a massive impact on that area, and so the successive generations of people were brought to Australia, their war experiences too, that we should hear that. And sometimes they were our enemies as well, which again would help to modify, I think, the Anzac myth.
That brings, as in Christians, that brings a really important side to it, I think. Actually, really interestingly, I had a similar sort of experience. So most of my ministry as a pastor was in a Chinese or a multicultural context. And in 2015, when it was the centenary of Anzac, one of the Chinese pastors at the church suggested we do an Anzac Day service, and we were all, the Anglo-Australian pastors, were really conflicted about that, because that was, we had a whole lot of different feelings about the church interaction with Anzac and war and so on. But from the Cantonese-speaking pastor, he saw that as I'm trying to reach out into your Australian traditions and what's important in Australian culture, which was, so we were kind of like, well, let's go with it. And in the process of doing that, it became quite a rich, I'd never done an Anzac Day service at church on the Sunday, but it became a really rich exploration for us as a community, some of those questions of how different people in the audience, like we had like an older lady who's German and so on, had really different experiences of war. And the, so we're able to sort of explore it in that gentle, Christ-soaked way.
Yeah, and that's perhaps the gift of the church to the Anzac tradition. It's perhaps a novel way of going forward on this and remembering that in a way which doesn't kind of make the Anzac myth an exclusive one. By the same token, it is interesting to see some commentators who come out very strongly against the Anzac myth being roundly criticised. So Yasmin Abdul-Majid kind of tweeted, and I think what she said was objectionable and ridiculous and silly. I don't agree with a pylon on her, but it kind of did expose the idol that Anzac has become.
It's become part of the culture wars, which I find really intriguing because, if anything, it's a really interesting myth for us to have our Australian identity founded on, because it is a story of defeat.
Yeah, yeah, it's fantastic, isn't it, to have a story of defeat, not victory.
Yeah, and so the new way of talking about it, where it sort of almost has that more triumphalist kind of feel to it, I feel like it's not in spirit with what it's always been. And I've always actually, as an Australian, been rather taken by that.
I think it's good. I think that's a healthy part of it. Of course, the real enemy is the British, not the Turks, in a way, although the Turkish president has kind of whipped that up lately. But the real enemy is the incompetence of the British and their willingness to use Australian men as cannon fodder. And so that's the real protest. In one sense, it's really the cricket ashes all over again, that sort of big brother, little brother, or cutting the apron strings, or whatever cliche you might like to use.
And so it always has been a richer, more complex tradition, and I would hate to lose that, because I think as a nation it's helped us to not glory in war in a way that perhaps some other nations might.
Be our guest, opening the conversation to others. Now, this is a new segment for us here at With All Due Respect, where we invite other people into the studio and ask them, get them to share, ask them questions. And, of course, we'd love you, the audience, to suggest people. But today we're very privileged to have with us Associate Professor of History at Avondale College of Higher Education, Daniel Renault, and he's here.
Welcome.
Welcome, I should say.
Thank you.
Hi, Daniel. And he's here as the author of a terrific book that I read last year called Anzac Spirituality, The First AIF Soldiers Speak. And it's a really interesting book because you get to hear in the book the voices of the soldiers having the Anzac experience and actually expressing their spirituality in various different ways. And this has been a suppressed part of the story. And so I think an atheist historian like Peter Fitzsimmons, he's not the only atheist Australian historian of Anzac, is really popularising the Anzac story without God in it. And yet God is a huge part of the story. Isn't that right, Daniel?
Yes, I think it's an unrecognised part. I read Bill Gammage's landmark book, The Broken Years. He'd read the diaries of 1,000 soldiers and used that as a basis for writing about what the Anzacs thought and felt and did. And early on he said there are three silences, sex, politics and religion, and the third was the most surprising. And that was the starter for me.
Yeah, so as in he had said, I can't hear God in the voices of the original Anzacs.
That's right.
And is that, in your research, is that actually true?
Well, the funny thing is it's not even true of Gammage's own book.
Right.
it's studded with quotes about faith and belief and values, which I suspect he didn't recognise, because there is quite a tradition in Australian historiography of leaving religion out. So it's an automatic, it's a given. But I kind of said to myself, look, you know, at least 10% of Australians went to church at that time. I'm betting that 10% of the Anzacs were religious. So I read the Diaries of a Thousand Soldiers.
So the same ones, or did you...
Well, I don't know exactly which ones he read. I read the ones that were available, so there's obviously probably some overlap.
Yes.
But still, it's the same sample size. Mm. And I was quite shocked. I found that well over a third spoke about God, faith, religion, values, which was far higher than I expected.
And did... I mean, was that a positive account on the whole? Or, I mean, did they like their faith? Did they identify as Christians? Were they prayerful or the opposite?
That's the striking thing again. More than a third speak about it, and an overwhelming majority of them are positive about religion. In fact, the thing they were most negative about, the soldiers hated the most, were the compulsory church parades on a Sunday. And you can imagine it. You know, it was several hours' work getting your uniform and kit immaculate. You're paraded, inspected. The colonel made announcements and church service. The whole thing could last from beginning to end, you know, several hours by the time you got ready. And so, yeah, they didn't like it. But I found... the striking thing I found is that the comments run 2-1 in favour of church parades.
Right, so they didn't like it, but they thought that it was still a necessary or important practice?
Well, that's the thing. We've assumed they didn't like it.
Oh, right.
But two-thirds of the comments are in favour. They're saying they enjoyed the parade, they got a lot out of the sermon, they loved the singing.
Oh, okay.
Now, the other third are the negative comments.
Yeah.
And about half of the negative comments were... It wasn't spiritual enough.
Right.
I don't like it when I can't take church seriously. The people around me are disrespectful. I want a respectful one. The preacher preached a weak sermon. I want a strong, vigorous, lively sermon.
Is some of that some... Because obviously, you know, you're only getting the one service there. Is some of that sort of all the different traditions that people will bring with them to the front?
Well, each brigade had four chaplains.
Right.
And it was either two Anglicans, one Catholic, and one Presbyterian / Methodist.
Right.
Occasionally they'd swap out one of the Anglicans for what they called the OPDs, the other Protestant denominations.
Which would probably be ours, right?
That's you, Megan.
Well, you got the Baptist, Church of Christ, Salvation Army, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And wherever possible, soldiers were given a choice of which parade they went to.
Oh, okay.
Now, often, once they got a bit of experience under their belt, they went to the most interesting chaplain or the one with the shortest sermons.
There's a lesson for us preachers.
Yes, not the one that was their nominal affiliation.
Right.
Yeah.
And so what about those chaplains? Were they hated or loved, or were they legends in the minds of the soldiers they served?
Well, like with everything else, there were... superb chaplains, good ones and mediocre ones and bad ones. But the surprising thing again is how popular chaplains were on average. Michael Gladwin's fantastic book, Captains of the Soul, brings that out as well. And it's what I found in reading the diaries. In fact, soldiers were more likely to talk about their chaplain than their colonel. And most of the comments about chaplains were positive. They really appreciated their work.
And so were there some, I know in the book actually you've got some great examples of these. Can you share with us an example of a chaplain or an incident involving a chaplain where they made that sort of impact?
Oh, so many. Walter Dexter, Anglican chaplain, bit of a legend, served the entire war. He's our most decorated chaplain. He deserves a biography. I've got one in mind. He was famous for pinching things that he couldn't get legally. I mean, all soldiers in all armies pinch things. It's the standard thing.
Yeah.
But to have the chaplain do it. And in fact, somebody wrote a very beautiful tribute to him, very respectful tribute, but very funny, called The Pinching Padre.
Did he do it for himself, or was it for other people? Was it like a Robin Hood thing?
Yeah, it was a Robin Hood thing. Right. For instance, he needed water tanks for his coffee.
Right.
And he couldn't get any, so he found some lying around and stole them. You know, it was that kind of thing. It was practical stealing, not kleptomania.
What?
I'm pleased to hear it. Yeah, but also, they're alongside men in times of extreme hardship.
Right? Absolutely. Now, the frontline chaplains, those who were attached to battalions, were doing things like burying soldiers in no man's land in the middle of a battle. You get William Mackenzie, the legendary Salvation Army chaplain, who stood on a mound at the Battle of Pozieres in no man's land at night and sang at the top of his very powerful voice a song that he'd composed called the Sunshine Song.
It was his own composition.
Yeah, and not a shot was fired.
Was it a hymn or...?
No, it's just a bright and cheery thing. It's four lines long, you know, though the way be dark and dreary and the, you know, but I carry my sunshine with me where I go. Mm-hmm. It was, yeah. And men like that really transformed soldiers' understanding of faith and God and belief.
So did you find, was there evidence of sort of that conflictual experience we can have with our faith and going into battle?
Absolutely. I don't know how many times people have said to me about this book, there's no atheists in foxholes. And I have to go, not in the first battle.
Right.
So there's a definite trend that men get serious and sober before their first battle. But once they've survived a few, they realise that the praying men die at the same rate as those that don't.
Mm.
And so faith is the magic bulletproof garment falls away. And, yeah, so I've actually got an entire chapter in my book on attitudes to war and God and the kind of puzzles and challenges that puts out. You know, when a faithful Christian friend is killed and a bunch of rotters right beside him survive, questions asked about God and... Yeah, really interesting questions.
So, I mean, the standard narrative is that the you know, the belief in God died in the battlefields of France, etc. Did people come home more cynical about religion or about their faith, and were they able to distinguish between maybe a cynicism towards state religion or a kind of associating of a sort of victory and triumphalism, and still maintain a personal faith?
That's a complex question.
I specialise in complex.
No worries. Look, on average, the war didn't change much. People found faith, people lost faith, people retained faith, people never got it.
Mm.
And the balance at the end is pretty much what it was at the beginning. What you do find, though, is that those who keep faith generally have less faith in institutional religion and a much stronger attachment to personal living faith.
I was really intrigued, I think it was something you said towards the end of the book, about that the RSL kind of had took over some of that institutional feeling.
Yes, well, see, the RSL didn't pass judgment.
Mm.
And what happened to religion on the battlefield was at variance with religion back home.
Mm.
Australian faith was extremely sectarian, very combative. On the front line, soldiers found that dropping away. You know, I've got case studies of Bible study groups that had everything from Anglicans to Seventh-day Adventists in them. Well, they wouldn't ordinarily mix.
No.
but they got on very well on the front line. And they come home and find this entrenched institutionalism, entrenched sectarianism, and they don't relate to it.
Mm.
The RSL is the only safe place, particularly as civilians in general didn't want to hear war stories. So the RSL became the safe place for their souls.
Right.
And became the default religion, if you like, of not just the religious Anzacs, but the irreligious.
So is that why we see, I mean, even today, that Anzac has become a quasi-religion?
Yes.
You know, it's got prayers and ceremonies and
liturgies. Many, many commentators, most of them secular, have observed that it is our new secular faith. We have a cathedral in the War Memorial. It's built like a church. It's lit like a church. We have local shrines. We have holy days. We have rituals and ceremonies. We have pilgrimages.
Oh, certainly. Yes, I've done it myself. Yeah.
Yeah. And the striking thing to me, again, one of the drivers for this book was we've turned the Anzacs into a faith without ever asking what the faith of the Anzacs actually was.
Mm.
And before we turn them into something spiritual. Let's find out what they found was spiritual.
Mm. And it's interesting you're saying that maybe it's part, I mean, obviously there's a whole lot of factors coming in, but maybe it's partly the way the institutional church responded to them when they came back that actually started down this pathway.
Definitely, I think so.
Mm.
But also the fact that certain denominations wouldn't allow their members to attend services of other denominations meant that Anzac Day had to take a non-sectarian approach that was inclusive.
Mm.
And so Anzac Day ceremonies and other rituals associated with you know, lest we forget, managed to bridge the divide that the churches never did.
Mm.
And so, again, it was a safe place for soldiers of all beliefs and no belief, whereas churches weren't.
I was reading that because there was an Anglican minister that started up in Queensland, so the first proper Anzac Day, kind of a lot of the things that we...
Canon Garland.
Yes, and that the moment of silence was because he didn't want to have a prayer there.
Mm.
He wanted people to pray in the moment of silence.
Yes, yes.
But I don't think that's my... I mean, that's not my experience of the moment of silence.
Look, I think Australia's tried hard to shed the religious vestiges of Anzac.
Mm.
But what we've done is transform it into a secular faith.
Mm. Yeah, I'd say I think that's very, very evident, and it's evident in particular in the way historians are sort of myth-making around Anzac. And is that partly why the faith of the Anzacs has been airbrushed out of history? Is that your explanation of why there is this... this kind of refusal to hear the Anzacs on their own terms?
Yes, I think so. One historian commented that Australian society has succeeded by removing religion from the discussion. Therefore, we haven't had the conflicts that characterise the old world.
Mm.
And we've mistaken that for us not being interested in religion. In fact, it's a tacit way of living with each other and not killing each other.
Mm.
It's disguised the fact that many Australians are profoundly spiritual and express it actively. And again, with the Anzac story, since we've manufactured them into the representatives of the ultimate Australians, the archetypical Australians, we've edited religion out of there again so that they could be universal, non-controversial representatives of Australia. And that's not the only thing. I mean, we've edited out race and all sorts of other things to make Anzac convenient for us. And I guess my work, along with many other historians, is to say, hey, we've forgotten something. A significant minority of the Anzacs were men of faith. It's estimated that 2/3 of all the Anzacs actually went to an evangelistic series run by a South Australian evangelist.
Oh, yeah, this was fascinating. There were actually missions, like evangelistic missions as we would know them, amongst the AIF.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about that story, the South Australian evangelist?
Well, he was based at an army depot behind the lines. And, well, he wasn't based there, but there was a depot behind the lines. And he came through and ran a series of meetings. And the chaplain who ran that depot calculated that 2 out of every 3 of the Anzacs attended at least one of his meetings.
This is in France.
This is in France. Yeah. It's phenomenal. It's unbelievable that 2/3 voluntarily went to an evangelistic program. That doesn't mean 2/3 of them were religious. It might mean 2/3 of them were bored silly and thought that was a good diversion, you know.
It's something to do, yeah.
But they went. This is the point.
Yeah.
But we're not allowed to talk about that.
Mm.
So you sent your book to Peter Fitzsimmons. What response did you get?
Well, when I offered to send it to him, he wrote back to say, look, you're welcome, but don't expect it to change my mind, which I thought was interesting because he had obviously decided a response before he'd read it. And after I sent it to him, there was a long silence. I contacted him several times and have yet to hear back.
Right.
Right. So it's a bit of an inconvenient truth. the spirituality of the Anzacs.
I'm not trying to argue that they're all religious, nothing of the sort. Mm. But in fact, strikingly, the levels of religiosity in the Anzacs is about the same level as in the British Army.
Mm.
And believe it or not, the American Army. And we've always known America was the most overtly Christian of the Western nations. The Anzacs were as spiritual as they were.
And a lot of the stories that we have, that say in cinema and so on, look at the faith of the soldiers in a way that I think the Australian stories that we tell don't.
Yes, look, I was really disappointed at a 2015 Gallipoli miniseries where they portrayed a Catholic chaplain at Gallipoli refusing to bury a non-Catholic.
Right.
And so they kind of hold a secular funeral service. Well, what really bugged me about that was the Catholic chaplains at Gallipoli were highly respected. They buried anybody.
Mm.
And the battalion that was shown in the movie was based on the 4th Battalion, whose chaplain was the legendary, Mackenzie, William Mackenzie.
Right.
If anybody was made for cinema, it's Mackenzie. He's this larger-than-life figure.
Mm.
But we couldn't do that. We couldn't have a true portrayal of an Anzac chaplain acting bravely.
Mm.
We had to make them a coward and then hold a secular service.
So where to from here? What's your next? What research should be done in the future on this?
I'm working on a follow-up book to Anzac Spirituality. This kind of surveys thematically.
Mm.
But I also want to tell the stories of individual men's spiritual journeys across a range of beliefs and non-beliefs.
Mm.
So my next book is, I think, about 25 Anzacs and tracing...
More of a narrative
and tracing their personal journey of faith or non-faith through the war.
Has anyone done the nurses, do you know?
No. There are a few nurses that I've mentioned in the book.
Mm.
Basically, there is insufficient source material to
right.
do a lot. However, I would note that proportionally the nurses were more religiously active than the soldiers.
There you go. Well, thank you so much for coming to visit us, Daniel, and being our first guest. And I would highly recommend this book, Anzac Spirituality, The First AI Soldiers Speak, and you can get it from all good bookshops. Well, no, you'll probably get it online. And
we'll put a link if you forget.
We will indeed. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Daniel.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Marg and Dave, reviews from two people obsessed by stories, but not always the same ones. In our Anzac Day special today, we are talking about Australian war songs. I thought this would be interesting because Australians on a whole tend to do a good line in conflicted war songs.
And war novels and war movies too, although we didn't want to watch a whole bunch of movies. I think that's...
it was shorter.
That's right. But you're right, conflicted war songs, not bellicose, not triumphalistic, but really... Really ambivalent. So, I mean, my favourite's probably, I've got two favourites. I think Kaisan by Cold Chisel, which is the song about a Vietnam War veteran. And it's interesting it's that war, which is such a difficult war for the veterans and the community to kind of reconcile with, because it was a bitter defeat and because so many people were opposed to it. And I think history has probably shown that it was an unjust conflict, or it was at least an ill-advised and badly carried out conflict.
Well, three of the songs that we're going to look at, so I'm looking at four songs, three of them are connected in to Vietnam. So Kaisan by Cold Chisel, which is 1978. I was only 19, 1983, Red Gum, but it looks back at Vietnam. And the band played Waltz and Matilda, which is about World War One, but it's written in 1972. It's written around the time of Vietnam. And all of those songs, I think, actually are very popular songs. They're part of, like, when we hear them, they kind of connect into our Australian identity. So it's very interesting that at some point around Vietnam, something happened to the way we saw ourselves.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the classic, the Kaisan, the guys in a pub kind of screaming out at the top of their voices is sort of an unofficial national anthem for the Australian cricket team at one stage. I think it's probably generationally moved on from that now. It's probably some rap song by somebody. If you look at the lyrics, it is this song of loss and being lost, being, you know, travelling the world and not finding a home.
Well, let's look at that one first then.
Great.
So lyrics, what lyrics there are lyrics of loss?
Well, it's, you know, I the answer sure ain't there. You know, I've flown choppers for an oil rig, and I've kind of the growing need for speed in Novocaine, and I came back home, my girlfriend was gone. That's not literally the lyrics, but you know, he kind of then there's a sort of cynicism about the women that are left whose minds are always open. Sorry, closed, but their legs are open.
It's quite, I mean, sex here.
It's kind of brutal.
Is sort of not a place of finding yourself either. It becomes sort of an empty. I mean, we could go into how, the idea of how women are portrayed here, which is a problem. But in and of itself, the way that the writer is talking about it, it's. There's no sort of place to find comfort.
No, I've been back to Southeast Asia, and the answer's right there. And then I'm going back to Hong Kong.
Goes back to Hong Kong to again have some meaningless sex.
That's not going to help. And yeah. That's where we're left. You know, the last plane out of Sydney is almost gone, and that's it. It's really, it really is despondent. So that the although the violence and the horror of Vietnam is not described, the terrible traumatic experience, it's left this sort of aching emptiness.
Yeah, this is the aftermath of having been in war.
That's true. But I think that was probably more the Anzac and Second World War experience than people admitted. Because people would tell me that, you know, Dad came home from the Second World War and he never complained about it. He never spoke about it. Mm. But he had an alcohol problem. Or my grandfather once told me the story of being in primary school with a World War I veteran who had shell shock. And, of course, being cruel children, they used to drop books on the floor to kind of... he'd fall asleep after lunch, and they would drop books, and he would just go nuts because it was like bombs going off again. He was a shattered man, and so I think it picks up that kind of feeling of disconnection and loss that's really there in the heart of war. Except with Vietnam, we had no glorifying veneer to coat it over.
Yes, and so so that kind of is the story of the song, and the band played Waltzing Matilda. Which has kind of been connected in, I think, with some of our feelings about Waltzing Matilda, which is, again, a one we connect very in closely to Australian soul, but it's an odd song, really.
Song of isolation, death, suicide, thieving.
Yeah. And so then here is Waltzing Matilda being, which often was played by bands, which often was a song that was taken to the front. But it's also written by, so it's written around the time of the Vietnam War, and it's written by Eric Bogle, who was a Scotsman. Who comes to Australia, and then he writes this song.
And so, what's the punchline of this song? What's the guts of it for you?
Well, it's sort of saying that they were used, that they were sold a lie about what it was going to be like when they get there. It's just a terrible experience. I mean, it talks about the shelling and the experience that is, and then. There's this cheering when they get there, the band playing Waltzing Matilda. But it's not a triumphant return.
No, and that was what was really lacking for the Vietnam generation. But also when you see pictures of the First World War generation with their wounds in their hospitals trying to recover, you realise that romanticising that war is false as well. You realise that devastation was there for them too.
But the interesting thing about the end of this song is it says, but year after year the numbers get fewer, someday no one will march there at all. In fact, actually that's not what has happened, as we've just been talking about. It hasn't sort of died off in the public imagination.
In fact, I've put my grandfather's medals on my son, who was in a band, you know, in a marching band, and I don't think my grandfather ever marched in Anzac, but those medals have now marched.
Which
they
on
never
your son.
Did. And I put them on my son, so his great grandson.
And what was his feelings or his experience of that?
Well, we were proud. You know, he was, it sort of was perhaps we were honouring something that he felt shame about or real difficulty about. He never spoke about it. He never really talked to us about
and
it.
And did you feel any conflict with doing that when you know that he hadn't worn them or he hadn't marched?
No. Maybe I should.
Am I sort of making that more conflicted for you now?
Now I'm more conflicted, yeah, that's right. So, well, I kind of felt like there was a suffering in his... There was something, there was a tension in his soul. And we wanted to say, you know, you did what you had to do and you probably didn't... You weren't in charge of what was going on, so...
Now, what I found really intriguing about band play called Waltzing Matilda is when I went to look for covers, because I have... a Spotify list for the songs we talk about.
Yes.
I'll put it on the
great
online. So I was putting songs in there, and I realised Waltz Matilda, the band play Waltz Matilda, has been covered by a whole lot of different people who aren't Australian.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's like one of the Australian songs that we sort of really hold to that has just found purchase amongst all sorts of different people around them, particularly folk musicians. But
right, so it's actually had it's travelled around the world, even though it's strongly identified by the name Waltzing Matilda.
Yeah, Australian and a very Australian story.
I'm surprised.
Story.
It's like finding out that Down Under's being covered by lots of you know, international bands, people
well,
from Iceland or something.
Shows that experience of war is a universal one.
Now, what about I Was Only 19 and by Red Gum, who really sang through their noses in as Australian accent
oh,
as
possible?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the sound of this is so Australian, isn't it?
Yeah.
I was actually looking to see whether a woman had sung this.
Yeah?
So would they have different... No.
And the answer is no.
No. yeah, I mean, this is another Vietnam one. Very visceral. Tell me, doctor, why I can't get to sleep. What's this rash that comes and go? God help me. I was only 19. I was reflecting because I don't think I'd ever thought about this, but coming up to this episode, God help me is a really strong refrain in this song.
It really is a cry of I was just an innocent boy and you put me in the jungle.
And it is kind of, I think, the cry that we have with war, God help us. Like, it's really actually war is a situation which leaves us mystified.
Yeah.
I mean, well, it should leave us mystified.
Well, it's got so many moral conundrums in it. I mean, watching the documentary called Vietnam, which came out, I think it's on Netflix actually, sort of very extensive interviews with combatant soldiers who are people who do not consider themselves to be psychopaths or murderers, but who have taken life. And to watch them wrestle with the fact that not just they were under fire and someone wanted to kill them, but the horror of actually having to kill another human that they have killed.
Mm.
That's to stare into the face of that, I think, was really, really profound. It shows you the moral complexity of war. This is a necessary. Mm. If it is necessary, it is a necessary evil.
Evil,
and we should never forget that. I think that's why you said the word "just war" is unsatisfactory because it does sound like, oh well, it's a justified war.
And this, I Was Only 19, takes issue with the Anzac tradition. So he says, and the Anzac legends didn't mention mud and blood and tears.
No, or did they?
Well, and I think what he means is the way that in the popular imagination. So, I mean, you could go there looking for, but the idea that you go off as a young person with that idea of there's something noble, and he's saying it's not a noble experience.
No, it's not a noble experience. Now, there's one last song that you've brought to my attention here, which
by
is
Wafia.
Very recent.
Well, it's 2017. Because I was thinking, do women write about war? And I asked this question, and a whole lot of people brought up women who sort of write songs about war. But in Australia, not so much. But the one that we found, I thought was really interesting. So she's a Syrian refugee background, and she put out a song called Bodies, trying to use the vehicle of song to talk about the experience back in Syria and why it should be one that we feel compassion for, that these are human beings. It is human bodies. This is the emotionally human reality behind, you know, all of the different political realities of the way they respond to refugees.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a very striking use of the word bodies, which in popular music you think you associate with sexuality, and yet it is the body, which is the body under violence, under the pressure of war.
And the song is quite a pop sounding song, so initially it has that vibe. You think it's going to go there, and she's an attractive singer, but yes, underneath that there is this idea of, yeah, we're all attracted to bodies. You know, you're listening to this because of that, but actually I'm trying to tell you a story of my people.
We are treated as, I mean, I think she's saying here, we're just bodies to the world. You know, we're just bodies in the night. It's an extraordinarily powerful lyric, and I urge you to listen to it if you haven't listened
and
to
I,
it yet.
And I would then say I'd love to see us talk about some of those experiences of refugees on Anzac Day. With All Due Respect is hosted by Michael Jensen and me, Megan Powell-Dutoit. This episode was produced by Alexander Bennett and Bella Ann Sanchez, and the sound design was done by Adam Jones. You can subscribe to With All Due Respect on iTunes, Spotify, or any of the other places you get your podcasts. And you can help us out by rating and reviewing the show on iTunes. That helps people to find out about the show and what it's about. I really encourage you to check out our show notes because they'll help you go deeper on some of the really important, interesting issues that I think we discuss. You can find them at eternitynews.com.au/respect. And you can come be part of the respectful conversation over on the Eternity News Facebook page or engage with us on social media.